And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
I hope you enjoyed that, Dean Haglund. That was a little bit of the theme from The Blob that played us in.
You know how we used to sing that on car trips?
And hold hands.
I don't remember the holding hands part. Was I drunk?
No, I mean, not each other's hands.
Oh, all right.
Severed hands. Okay. Severed hands that we would collect along the road in rural locations. Which leads us right into the theme of today's show. And by the way, hey, to everyone in the USA, happy Labor Day. And to the rest of you, happy Monday.
Hey, look at that.
We had
been Labor
Day. No, what? Go, please.
No, it could be Labor Day. Yeah, you're right. It's not Labor Day everywhere, is it?
No, thanks for backing me up on that.
Sorry.
This show is all about horror films. We've been threatening to do this for a while. This in year 10, it's kind of my dream that we do 10 top 10 shows to commemorate year 10 of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
And this look at you go.
This would be the first of them. We are 8 weeks out from Halloween, so what better time than now to discuss our top 10 all-time horror films so that our loyal listeners will have time to maybe avail themselves of some of these titles in anticipation of All Hallows Eve.
Yes. What a perfect way to celebrate All Hallows Eve than just sit down with a ton of horror movies.
So get those Netflix cues handy, and we will begin. Do you have any honorable mentions, Dean, that didn't make your list, but that you kind of felt like, boy, I wish I could have this on the list?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, there's the one that stuck out, because there's so many here, you know, that either scared me, that I have a personal connection to, that I remember seeing as a kid, and then there's the one that both you and I enjoyed, Cabin in the Woods, which sort of put an end to all teen horror movie woods, put a kibosh on watching all of those with that hilarious. But it's not really a horror movie. It's a comedy about horror movies.
It's interesting because it kind of plays to me the way that Blazing Saddles played in the early 70s, right? Blazing Saddles was not a Western. It was a comedy parodying Westerns. But damn if it didn't actually, at the same time, give you some of the enjoyment that you would get from Westerns. And
absolutely.
I feel that that's very much the case with Cabin in the Woods. It's taking the piss out of it, but at the same time, it's actually letting you enjoy some of the things you enjoy about horror films.
Exactly. So it's sort of an outlier that stands alone, and yet at the same time, it was on my list for a long time, but then didn't make my list. So now it sits in parentheses on a pedestal and or at the bottom as its own special honorable mention and or perhaps my favorite horror movie ever, if I'm looking at it not in a scary way.
Right, in a certain perspective. You know, I guess one of the ones that I believe is worthy of honorable mention is more of a gothic horror film. And I'd never really quite knew what to do with gothic horror, because these are not the sort of stories that are really, quote-unquote, scary. And maybe my favorite gothic horror is from Guillermo del Toro, and it's his most personal film. It was The Devil's Backbone, set during the Spanish Civil War at an orphanage. It was a 2001 film. And like gothic horror, it's more about dread and sadness and tenderness than scares. It's a great film, but I wanted to delve more into genuine nightmares with my list.
Right. Yeah. So therefore, you leave that one Well, see, you know, so some of my horror is a personal, the horror from the personal vision to me is more scary that this is going through some.
Well,
some
no, I mean,
mind.
this is why instead of talking about what we mean by horror and what we're looking for, I thought it might be interesting to talk about our outliers that didn't make the list, because we're already getting a sense, like for you, that yes, Cabin in the Woods can't exist without the horror genre. So therefore, right, it is part of the horror genre, but it stands outside what you want to be celebrating at this point. And for me, that's true with, you know, Devil's Backbone. I probably love it as a movie more than I love some of the ones on my list. But in terms of what I wanted to celebrate today, it didn't seem to fit in. I had a couple others that I couldn't. There were two in particular I could not decide between. And so I left them both off. And it was both the 1956 original and the 1978 remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Ah, very good.
I mean, I love both of them, right? I love the Don right. Siegel original that played on the Red Scare of the time and on our you know, need to see the strangers among us, right? And then the remake by Philip Kaufman, which got an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay, right? Both were huge hits, and the remake deals with the cultural and emotional upheaval that was going on in the 1970s, right? When we're getting in touch with our feelings, which, of course, is very, very scary to a kind of traditional, masculine, stiff upper lip kind of crowd. So they
absolutely,
you know, they they're such wonderful companion pieces to each other, and I didn't know how to separate them, so neither made my list. But again, both worthy of mention in this. Did you have any others that didn't quite fit the list?
Well, yeah, some of the classics. I mean, you know. What Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein, as funny as it is, Costello, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello are a comedic team, but him demonstrating fear in a comedic way actually resonates as really scary for me as a kid, because I used to love watching comedies, and then watching this one where he meets Frankenstein and his genuine fear in the coffin scenes where the candle's moving is probably comedic to me now and an adult audience. But as a small child watching it at 2 o'clock in the morning by myself in my basement in Canada, that was truly genuinely frightening. So,
you know what? I agree with you. In fact, I would say that it was really my introduction to Frankenstein as something really affecting and haunting was that movie, because it would be years later before I could really appreciate, like, Bride of Frankenstein.
Right, exactly. So all the Frankenstein, like, if that's your, if Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein as your way into Frankenstein movies, then, yeah, it takes a while for that to reconfigure. And I actually have Bride of Frankenstein because I think that's such a great movie, but I don't know if that sits on my list or not.
Well, so I have one other that I wanted to mention. I couldn't believe that I was leaving John Carpenter off the list. I loved John Carpenter when I was coming of age, and you know who contributed more to horror during his prime than he. And my favorite of his horror films is actually the one that was probably his least successful at that time, panned by critics, another remake, this time The Thing from Another World. And it's John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah. Was that panned?
It was panned at the time. And it did much lower box office, than expected. And so it was panned, I believe, because it was too apocalyptic and too nihilistic for critical tastes at the time. And it did lower than expected box office because that was a time where we wanted certainly our extraterrestrial movies. There was a little movie that came out earlier that month called E.T. And even our horror films like Toby Hooper's Poltergeist, we wanted them touchy-feely at that point in time. And this badass, apocalyptic, nihilistic film just didn't jibe with that at the time. Of course, the years have been kind to it, and it has been reappraised as a classic of its genre. But I would have that as my favorite John Carpenter, but I just didn't have room for a Carpenter film on here, and I wish I did. Oh. It probably would have been number 11 on my list if I did. But why don't we start with our top 10, and why don't you take it away?
Okay, well, for me... there's no better experience if you're living in Los Angeles than to head over to Disney Hall on All Hallows Eve and see a screening of John Barrymore's 1920 Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with full pipe organ accompaniment playing. I saw this, I don't know, 8 years ago now when they first opened it, and it's a lovely remaster, and it is genuinely a deep dread, like a terror that only can come from the egomaniacal John Barrymore actor as he does this. I don't know if you've ever experienced it. The silent film, when they show it on TV, it's done with just a tinny recording of a symphony orchestra, but to hear it with the full pipe organ going on in Disney Hall with the 1,000 ranked pipes going and laying it on thick, it is an amazing visceral experience. And so Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde from 1920 is my number 10.
I wonder, that might be our oldest film on this list, maybe?
Which one?
Dr. Jekyll, the one you just mentioned. Might that be the oldest film that we discussed today? Maybe.
It might be. I got Nosferatu on here, too.
Oh, so a little bit older. Well, so we go from a really old title to probably, I would argue, the most recent title that we'll talk about, and that is my number 10. It's one of my top films from last year. It Follows. From writer-director David Robert Mitchell. It stars a largely unknown cast. The plot, for those who haven't seen it, it follows a girl pursued by a supernatural entity after a sexual encounter. She learns that you have to pass the entity off to another sexual partner or it will kill you. And if it kills that partner, it will then resume its pursuit of you. Mitchell conceived the film based on recurring dreams he had in his youth about being followed. It's fantastic because already you can tell from that plot line that the subtext is rich with thematic possibilities.
And
critics have had numerous interpretations of the film in regard to the source of it in the title and the film's symbolism. They've interpreted it as a parable about AIDS, about other transmitted
STDs.
Infections, about the social perceptions of the sexual revolution, of primal anxiety. Primal anxiety about intimacy. But what I love is that Mitchell's more interested in it as a dream. It came to him as a dream, and he tries to keep it in that context. It's not that the dream can only be understood as a dream. No, it's realistic, but it's set in a realistic world of a dream. And in that place, for me, what I love and what I've always been struck by is that the impulse, i.e. the sexual impulse, that brought on imminent death for this girl and for these other people, a sexual procreative impulse, is the same impulse that will keep them alive. And deep in our psyches, we understand that life is what will ultimately kill us. Right?
The irony.
Yeah. Which is why, more than death, what we often fear is life itself. And so that really resonates with me on a you know, on level of the psyche, furthering the dreamlike quality of this, like I said, nevertheless realistic world. And we've talked about this before, is I love that the props and the production design and its and the technology owe to no one time or era. It's from all times and all eras.
Yeah.
You have vintage TVs, but then within antique-looking compacts, you find that they contain mobile devices.
Mm-hmm.
The film was shot very effectively in Detroit, Michigan, and they used wide-angle lenses to give the film a quite expansive look so that you had to check constantly these wide, deep frames to see if anything out of the ordinary was taking place.
Yeah.
And it really increases the tension. It's reminiscent of John Carpenter, who I mentioned, and also George Romero, especially in terms of the film's compositions and its visual aesthetic.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I will say, as just a little foreshadowing, the climactic showdown with it also evokes the number 9 film on my list, which I believe it overtly references. So should I mention what that is? Should I just...
Yeah, because I'm trying to think. I saw it recently, and I loved it, and I agreed.
So that...
I actually thought it was shot in the 70s, but...
yeah, I mean, it...
Yeah.
It could be. I mean, that's what's so cool about it.
But
think the climax at the pool intentionally evokes Let the Right One In.
Oh my God, that's my number 9, Let the Right One In.
Well,
but the Swedish version, not the American remake.
Of course, the 2008 film from Sweden from writer John Lindqvist and director Thomas Alfredson, who of course has gone on to direct the terrific remake of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Let the Right One In is actually one of several films on my list that deals with the conflict again between primal sexual urges and the responsibilities bestowed upon us when we quote unquote come of age.
Right. Yes. A coming of age tale that is actually filled with not just the dread of coming of age, but what that responsibility means of being an adult.
You know, we talked when this came out about how much it spoke to you, you know, this boy and your upbringing in snowy northern climes, and how you really could relate to some of this, right down to kind of the meanness of some of the people in this rural area, even.
Yeah. Just the opening scene of a dark winter's night and him standing at the window with the TV on. I believe it's set in 1986.
It's 81.
Which again,
it's set in 81.
81.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's exactly like around my time, and evoking just that longing to get the hell out of there, and at the same time, the dread of a winter's night, a cold, cold winter's night. All of it done so well.
We talked so much about how it evoked your childhood that when I saw it again, I was surprised to find how much I related to it. And I realized that in 1981, I was the exact same age as the protagonist in this film,
right.
Oscar. And it was a time when I was truly experiencing the nuclear nightmares alluded to in this film. I mean, I really, when I was 12 years old, I was really scared that death was about to come from above and was only 30 minutes away. And I planned out how I would spend that last half hour I was given. Of course, what's fascinating about that is puberty and the onset of puberty, which is where the character was when I was at that in 1981, is death on many levels, right? Our bodies are being taken from us. So we're right. Death is imminent. And for people who don't know, Oscar is this 12-year-old boy. His classmates regularly bully him. He spends his evenings imagining revenge, collecting clippings from newspapers and magazines about grisly murders. And one night he meets Eli, who appears to be a pale girl his own age.
Right.
And she has recently moved in next door apartment with an older man and who we think at first must be her father. And Eli initially informs Oscar that they cannot be friends. Over time, however, they do form a close relationship, and Eli learns that the boy is being bullied and encourages him to stand up for himself. And at the same time, we begin to learn that the older man kills people to harvest fresh blood for Eli, and that Eli is much older than she appears.
Right. And yes. And that as a true vampire lore, you the vampire cannot come into your home. It has to be invited.
Right.
Hence the title. You have to let the right one in.
So what I love, though, is that we are cutting back and forth between these two storylines, and they're both very scary realities. The vampire reality, but then the boy who's getting bullied at school is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that both of those, that are sort of mirror each other, because Eli's caretaker is also dying, isn't he? Like, it's been so long that I've seen it. Now that you're
I think we might be getting to spoiler territory. We're getting very far into the I love, obviously, the snowy, desaturated look. I love the restrained, thoughtful relationship that develops between these two kids. I love that the film is poignant and touching and haunting, and one that certainly anyone who sees it will never forget. I think we're not going out on any limb to say it's the best horror film of the first decade of the 21st century, but to me, it's really the harbinger of what was to come in this new international golden age of horror.
Right, right. That this is that all countries learned how to do horror films and be able to sell them to a market, because horror translates internationally. Fear is fear. Once you have it's on a visceral level, and we experience it globally.
Though sometimes when you transfer it from one shore to another, as they attempted to do with Let the Right One In, and translated it into Let Me In, there's something missing, right? When you're connecting deeply with some part of a local community, especially a community for whom tradition and the past and history is alive in a way that is really foreign to most Americans, it's hard to transplant those stories here, even though, as you say, fear is still fear. What's number eight for you?
Number eight, of course, 1968. You think horror movies have been going on for some time, and yet here is a movie that develops a whole new, class of horror movies. The first zombie movie, Dawn of the Dead by George Romero.
No, don't you mean Night of the Living Dead?
I mean, Night of the Living Dead, not Dawn of the Dead.
Yes,
Night of the Living Dead, the very first zombie movie. And how effectively. He shot it over four weekends just outside of Philadelphia. And you look at it, and it's actually, you could see it. He maybe had two lights working and a 16-millimeter camera. And some of the performances are wacky. But just, the innovation to come up with, oh, you know, be scary, undead, and they walk slowly, and they're relentless. And to come up with this after, you know, how many people have sat down and thought, oh, I need a new scary subgenre of horror. What would it be?
$114,000 budget. Film grosses in its initial release $30 million worldwide on a $114,000 budget. Those are not adjusted dollars. That's 1968, $30 million.
Good Lord.
And of course, it's been a cult classic and a moneymaker ever since. What I think, again, is interesting, again, for any kind of these groundbreaking horror films, so often heavily criticized and panned upon its release. Especially because of its explicit gore. And yet, has history been kind to it? Well, it was one of the films selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry because it was deemed, quote, culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant.
Yeah, see? Well, exactly. Because so many people, I mean, you wouldn't have The Walking Dead, you wouldn't have any of the other zombie movies without this this one. And I don't think anyone else could even, like, to conceive of a whole new scary monster, basically.
So
the, to have the zombie.
To me, it comes back to the premise, right? That is so brilliant. You work a premise that fits perfectly the resources you have. It's George Romero's first film, and he figured out, what do I have access to? What premise makes sense with what I have access to? And then also, though, what premise allows an audience to understand what these characters are feeling at all times, even if the performances aren't necessarily polished professional performances. And so this simple plot, seven people trapped in a rural farmhouse in western Pennsylvania, which is attacked by a large and growing group of unnamed living dead, that's all you need. And then... there's such wonderful subtext to it.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. And visual imagery of the police coming out with the guard dogs, you know, replicating the civil rights violence and all that sort of thing.
So here's a black and white film. There's some telling thematic subtext there. And shocking, in 1968, the only one to survive, the black man, right?
Yeah.
That's subversive. Yeah. But then before you get to pat yourself on the back for living, before you get to give yourself moral licensing for living in a country where the black man's the only one to survive the horror film, the sheriff's posse arrives.
Yeah.
He survives the zombie apocalypse only to be the victim of racism.
How ironic.
Well, that's number eight for you. Number eight for me, getting back to this idea of international, is Ringu, the 1998 Japanese psychological horror film directed by Hideo Nakata. Adapted from the novel Ring by Koji Suzuki, which would then be made into the American The Ring film.
The Ring. Oh, okay. I didn't know that's the original name of it.
It draws from an old Japanese folktale, and the film follows a TV reporter and single mother who is investigating a series of deaths surrounding a cursed videotape. Production on this thing took about 9 months because they produced it and its sequel at the same time, and they were released in Japan at the same time. That's how sure of this they were. The film, I love the opening to the film. Two teenagers are talking about a videotape recorded by a boy, and it's fabled the bear curse that kills the viewer 7 days after watching it. Well, one of the girls then reveals to her friend that a week ago, she and three of her friends watched a weird tape and received a call after watching it. And no sooner does she tell this to her friend than she is killed by an unseen force as her friend watches on, horrified. That's an opening to a movie right there.
That is a fantastic opening.
And, you know, critics have talked a lot about how Ring is about how modern Japanese culture is in a fight to the death conflict with traditional Japanese culture. And it's also, to me, about a modern ambivalence that they were seeing in the workforce, of women in the workforce, towards the concept of motherhood. This was really challenging for their culture to deal with on a subtextual level. Anyway, that coupled with the way ghosts are, how they are truly alive in Japanese culture, to me, those are elements that could never be transplanted to these shores in the American remake. And I got to tell you, I saw this film at home on 133 on video with friends. And I'm sitting there with guys on the couch. And when the true nature of the videotape is revealed, I literally almost wet myself. It's that goddamn scary.
That's fantastic. And I, of course, love the production design of this as well. I mean, the idea of just... a la ghost, you know, normally the ghost is in white, but here to have her hair cover her face for most of the time, as almost the, you know, traditional long sheet that is the stereotypical ghost, is a fantastic, both feminine and old world, yet modern. It's really great.
The woman with whom I lived at the time was able to ape that look to a T, and would do it in the middle of the night for the sole purpose of scaring the living hell out of me. And did and did just that repeatedly. So we are no longer together. Number seven, Dean Haglund. What's number seven on your list?
Number seven, as we talked about earlier, well, I had a switch, but it was, I was thinking of the thing, but it actually what scared me more, Candyman. Do you remember this one?
I do remember Candyman.
So Candyman, you say Candyman three times in a mirror and this spirit appears and it's malevolent and it's terrifying. And also what was great about this, I mean, there's so many visual elements. The toilet full of bees, it's set in the projects of, I think it's supposed to be Philadelphia, but maybe it was Brooklyn.
Right, this is an urban horror film. Which is quite kind of sets it apart.
Yeah, yeah, and how about that musical score by Philip Glass? You know, you hear that minimalist music all the time, but to put that to a full on monster, scary modern urban horror movie, it was a fantastic marrying. So Candyman is my number seven.
Number seven for me is Tobe Hooper's 1974 landmark, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, God, yes.
Who, this is the ad line, who will survive and what will be left of them?
Right, right, exactly.
And that's kind of how that... I felt when I walked out of the theater upon seeing it. upon its October 1974 release, it was banned outright in many counties and countries. Numerous theaters stopped showing the film in response to complaints about its violence. It received kindly, we'll call it, a mixed reception from critics, and yet it was enormously profitable, grossing over $30 million at the domestic box office, $30 million in the U.S. without adjusted on a budget of only $300,000. It's credited with originating several elements common to the slasher genre, including its use of power tools as murder weapons. Somebody had to start that. And the yes. characterization of the killer as a large, hulking, faceless figure. It's, of course, overcome that early pan. History has been kind to it. It's been appraised as one of the greatest horror films of all time. I saw it in film school more than 12 years after its release, knowing all about it, and it still left me wrung out and raw. Like, I wasn't sure what was left of me, even though I knew all about it, right?
Right, yeah.
I love how it plays into our fear of being isolated in unknown terrain and the danger of strangers. Don't trust strangers even when you need their help, right? I mean, and look, the problem is never with an original. It's with the countless craven imitators, and the things that people thought made this successful were too easy, like the power tools, too easy to imitate, right?
Right, yeah, and so you had a ton... And they're still making them. Hills Have Eyes, Devil's Rejects, all that kind of thing.
Slightly based on the, or inspired by the real life Ed Gein, Tobe Hooper said that it was changes in the cultural and political landscape that were the central influences on the film. His intentional misinformation that, quote, the film you are about to see is true, because it says that, but it was right. intentional misinformation, was a response to his feeling lied to by our government about things that were going all over the world, including Watergate, the 73 oil crisis, the massacres and atrocities in the Vietnam War. So he said, screw it, I'm going to lie to people, and I'm going to make them feel exactly like I feel about being lied to.
Interesting.
The lack of sentimentality and the brutality of things that Hooper noticed while watching local news and the graphic coverage, which he describes as showing brains spilled all over the road in the local news, led to his belief that man is always the real monster, just wearing a different face. So I decided to put a literal mask on the monster in my film. And, you know, as I looked back at this list, I realize, you know, I kind of think the late 70s might just be the high point of motion picture horror. I already mentioned, although it didn't quite make my list, Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake. Here's Chainsaw Massacre. But because of all the social upheaval at the time, yeah, and what we were wrestling with culturally, it might just have been the high point. So that's my number seven.
I would think so, because it's also the time of Roger Corman and Hammer Films, and they, you know, churning out one after another, even if they're mere sad sequels and replications of other horror things. I could see that happening. I'm reminded of a hilarious guy making a trailer up in Vancouver that was supposed to be the next Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it was about a tow truck driver out on the lonely roads of British Columbia who murdered everybody who broke down. And the movie's title was Chunk Blower.
I remember that.
Yes. Do you remember that? I don't know if it ever got made. I know they made the trailer and basically used the device, which is known in stunt world as the chunk blower, which blows the back of your head off and you fill it full of chunks and it goes all over. And so the guy had that air compressor device, which he used over and over again in the trailer, and then just called the movie Chunk Blower, named after the one special effect device that he had that he was going to build his horror movie around.
Not surprisingly, we need to pick up the pace.
Yeah, right. Well,
number six, Dean.
My number six and my number five are closely related because it's the 1931 Bela Lugosi's Dracula. Fantastic classic where Bela Lugosi, of course, had to learn it all his words phonetically, giving it the extra chills. And that, of course, was a remake of the 1922, I'd looked it up, Nosferatu, which was the very first vampire movie starring Max Schreck, which is the German word for terror, Schreck. And it was rumored that he himself played the role so well because he was a vampire.
Yeah, was one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So Nosferatu and Dracula are my six and five,
respectively. Well, that helped. If you would like to take more time to talk about chunk blowers, you may now.
Well, I got more to talk about when we get closer up.
Number six for me, Repulsion, 1965. Roman Polanski's low-budget and extremely popular psychological horror tale starring Catherine Deneuve as a young woman who is left alone by her vacationing sister at their apartment and begins reliving traumas of her past in horrific ways. It was shot in London. It was Polanski's first English-language film, his second feature-length film altogether, following Knife in the Water. The title refers to the repulsion that the main character feels about human sexuality and the repulsion visited upon her suitors when they pursue her. This film is so rich with subtext involving an exploration, unspoken, of sexual abuse she experienced as a child, which is the basis for her neuroses and her breakdown. And also the psychological and social dangers of refusing to conform. That's what's interesting about how if you refuse to conform, you are inviting certain kind of breakdown because the pressures are so severe. And boy, this is interesting terrain in the hands of someone like Polanski. In fact, it's terrifying in the hands of Polanski to be dealing with this topic of the path of femininity that a woman is supposed to follow and the breakdown that might happen if she fails to do so. Because let's face it, this is a man who witnessed firsthand what happens when people are too willing to conform, right? Having survived the Holocaust, but watching all of his family and loved ones killed in front of him. So it's fascinating. It's shot, like I said, on a really low budget in black and white, but by a great cinematographer, Gilbert Taylor, who had already shot both Dr. Strangelove and A Hard Day's Night.
Both and using the black and white, he knew how to light it and all that.
So even though it's really low budget, it looks spectacular. And what I love is it increasingly uses the perspective of its protagonist. We're sharing her worldview. So there's what we think are probably dream sequences that are particularly intense as a result. I'll just say this. Even when I saw this film for a second time, because the film's about so much stuff, I wanted to watch it a second time. And I was watching it in a home, a well-lit home, again on home video, watching with two other grown men. And we still, all of us, screamed in terror because the film is that scary.
Wow. So, well, that's fascinating that you should pick that.
Well,
so I got five.
Now I got to get, no, that's my number six. I now, remember you did six and five. So now I'm at number five.
Right.
Okay. And then we'll be caught up. We'll do our tops four with the 80 seconds that are left. Okay. Number five. Number five. I almost didn't put this because I've seen it so many times that I wouldn't say that it's scary anymore, but it's Steven Spielberg's Jaws.
Right. I was surprised to even think of that. Like I went through, oh, other people's scary list. Jaws technically is a horror movie.
Yeah, and it's hard to throw yourself back to what it was like the first time you saw it. Look, it launched summer blockbusters. It did prey on our fear of the deep that really affected and affects people to this day, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I was working at a swimming resort. Everybody screamed shark anytime a minnow nibbled their toe. They all freaked the hell out that summer.
Well, at the same time, it introduced a real, multifaceted ensemble character acting into the genre. And and it explored the ways, again, like what Toby Hooper was saying, that human failings, monstrous human failings of greed and bureaucracy and short-sightedness are the true evils in our world. And it's those evils that leave us susceptible to all that we cannot control in nature, right?
Well, exactly, yes. They try to close the beach, but we got to keep it open for July 4th. That's the government talking.
Yeah, and so I love that the struggles involved in the making of the film mirror and inform the story being told, right? These characters could really drop into these conflicts very well. It is surprisingly still scary, I guess. And it is one of the films on this list that everyone can enjoy, even if they don't find it scary. It works that well as a character film as well.
Absolutely, and there's some real good laughs in there. And like you said, the shark failed as originally as planned. It was supposed to be a big mechanical shark, and you had lots of shots of it in the storyboard, but because it didn't work right, Spielberg worked around that limitation and actually made a scarier movie than he probably originally intended.
It's interesting because you've always said he's a great first act director. And yet here's a film where structurally it does work first, second, and third act, but significantly not the way it was originally scripted to work, right? Because the shark's supposed to show up in the first act, but it didn't work, so they knew they had to save it for the third act.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I also say he's the best second unit director.
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, number four for you, sir.
Wow, look at you. We're back to Roman Polanski, and nothing scarier than the beginning of all devil and Satan movies, Rosemary's Baby. This is a 1968 movie with Mia Farrow as a young couple moves into this. What is now a very posh New York neighborhood, and all the neighbors are weird and occurrences start happening, and then she's suddenly mysteriously pregnant, and everybody starts gathering around. And if you want to see how to compose frames of movie shots with multiple characters sitting and standing, look no further than this movie, just in terms of still shots of just the camera lingering on your weird neighbors and just having that stillness be the horror. That is what frightens me the most about this movie.
I, of course, love it. Though, to me, it's a comedy, not a horror film. I also,
what? Really?
I also don't even think that it's scary. But to me, it is a comedy, and it's always tough to tell with Polanski, honestly. But if I was going to have a second Polanski, and if this list expanded out to 20, I would have had The Tenant instead of Rosemary's Baby, because I think it's both funnier and scarier while still using the same tone. But on the other hand, you picked a film with John Cassavetes in it, and I think that's the first time that's ever happened on any list we've done, so hats off to you.
That's right. So there you go. Well, that's interesting. The Tenant, eh?
Yeah.
That's a scary thing. And you see this as a comedy, and yet she is giving birth to Satan, theoretically. But, well, I don't know. I saw it, and I got chills, and I was freaked out. Now, I saw it by myself, and it was late night TV again. So maybe, you know, I should just not watch those movies at 2 a.m.
My number four is a subversive film about racial violence in the United States and the horrors of the Vietnam War. It's from 1968. It's George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, and we already talked about it.
Yeah, we sure have.
So what's your number three?
That's your number four. My number three, of course, what other movie started it all for in terms of jump scares and teen screams than Halloween? The very first one with Jamie Lee Curtis. That guy was relentless. It was frightening. Well done as a movie. And that I remember giving me the heebie-jeebies for quite some time, particularly anybody in a hockey mask, which you would see often being in Canada.
Well, but wait a minute. I thought you said Halloween.
I'm sorry, what?
Didn't you? Wasn't your Halloween, not Friday the 13th, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Halloween.
So Friday the 13th is the hockey mask.
Yeah, what was the...
Halloween is a Captain Kirk mask.
Oh, that's right.
It's a bleached Captain Kirk mask. That's the little trivia that people don't realize is that William Shatner's face appears throughout Halloween. Anyway, well, I'm glad you had that, because I thought about going and rewatching Halloween just for the purpose of, like I said, having a John Carpenter on there. And how about the score that he wrote himself for that? Anyway, yeah, and it's surprising, I think, to people who grew up with kind of the slasher genre to go back and watch something like Halloween and realize just what a great movie it is, right?
It really is, yeah. And to see those tropes originally laid out, how original that stuff was.
One of my 10 favorite science fiction films of all time is number 3 on my list of top 10 horror films of all time.
Well, there could only be one horror sci-fi crossover that I could think of.
And that's, of course, Spectres from 2005, starring Dean Haglund, Tucker Smallwood, and... No, it's not. Okay.
Oh, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Wouldn't that have been awesome? It's, again, from this high point of the late 70s, 1979, from director Ridley Scott, Alien.
Yeah.
I love it as a working class view of what life aboard a starship in outer space would really be like. I love it as a futuristic haunted house movie, because I always loved haunted house movies, right? Going back to Abbott and Costello. I mean,
yeah.
I love it as an ensemble comedy. I love how it plays into our primal fear of the unknown, of our own insignificance in the cosmos, of our distrust that machines might take over. I mean, think about that. It starts a franchise, spawns countless offspring in the direction of both the alien and the tech run amok subgenres.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
A strong female action protagonist in a mainstream movie in 1979. And in fact, there's an interesting, an incredibly interesting feminist reading of this film. And certainly the monster is this archaic mother archetype. And the film,
for sure.
And the film really capitalizes on deep-seated masculine fears of rape and penetration. I'm going on record as saying there will never be a better fusion of horror and science fiction.
I would agree with you, and what a great way. One of the problems when every time you make a horror movie is how do you contain your characters to be in proximity with your scary monster? Because normally your flight or your run response is just to get in a car and drive really fast to get the hell away from this thing. But to put it in a self-contained spaceship that only, you know, has to self-destruct, you are literally dependent on that as your life source, and you have an escape pod. But even that is, spoiler alert, a thrilling third act. The cleverness of that in and alone of where to stick your monster in space is such a great idea.
Yeah, you know, when they spun off the second franchise, the Alien versus Predator franchise, they should have been paying attention to what you're saying right now, that it works best in this enclosed environment. But how do you maintain that? It's why you could only make so many haunted house movies, right? I give you $1 million dollars if you can spend a night here, right? But most of us would go, okay, fuck it. It's not worth it. I'm out of here. But here they couldn't go anywhere. So if you really want to do something like that, they shouldn't have done Alien versus Predator. They should have done Alien versus Die Hard. Right?
Oh, yeah.
The guys have locked down the building. You've got some people working against them. And in the midst of this is Alien. Taking out
now
both
that
of them.
Would have been fantastic. I think there's still room for that one.
Do we have your number three yet? Oh, you did Halloween. We're at your number two.
My Halloween.
Your number two.
My number two, yes. Now, this one made for, I think the budget was $25,000. And it's from my favorite Winnipeg director, Guy Madden. This is Tales from a Gimli Hospital. Now, I don't know if you've seen this. It's
you've talked
typical...
about this. This is disturbing.
I did tell you.
Just reading about this is disturbing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's so frightening. The imagery is so scary. Guy Madden still shoots in black and white using vintage cameras and obscure lenses that he finds lying around. And this tale set in a Gimli hospital, I'm not even sure what the hell the narrative is half the time, which is typical to a Guy Madden film. But the imagery, particularly the rocking of the single light bulb back and forth in the hospital, and every time the light flies back to the back of the room, the other patients have changed position and are coming closer. But in still motif, holy crap. Just that scene alone is frightening.
Okay, I'm watching that before Halloween. That's the one that's my ritual this year. That's my All Hallows Eve of viewing. Tales from the Gimli Hospital. My number two relates to your number three in that you could not have had John Carpenter's Halloween if you did not have this movie, much like you could not have had the star of Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis, unless you had her mother, Janet Leigh. From 1960, Psycho. This is, if you'll pardon the Freudian expression, Dean, the mother of the slasher genre.
That's true.
Groundbreaking in terms of structure, style, psychology, and in its treatment of sexuality. The film centers on the encounter between a secretary, played by Janet Leigh, who ends up at a secluded motel after stealing money from her employer. So we have an embezzler and an adulterer who is our protagonist, we think. And she then meets up at the secluded hotel with the motel's disturbed, yet oddly charming and touching, owner-manager Norman Bates. And in its aftermath, Janet Leigh, every bit the movie star, and never more so than in this film, dies in the first act. The movie we think we've been watching is not the movie we came to watch at all. And that was horribly shocking to people on the level that you just that didn't happen. You just couldn't do that. It really affected people and made you suddenly realize that anything could happen at any time.
Yeah. It so set you off balance.
Yeah.
That you can't believe it. And of course, that shower scene, what is it, 63 shots?
Well, so think about this. Like, it sets you, like you said, it sets you off balance. Well, this is what the movie does so brilliantly every step of the way. How about the casting of Anthony Perkins? It's hard for us to remember this now, but he was consistently, up until the point, every time out, the youthful matinee idol good boy love interest.
Oh,
up
right,
until that time, he would never be seen that way ever again. And then how about, what you're saying, like the thing to me about the shower scene and why it's so unsettling even to this day is not just the style of how it's shot, but the very idea that it's playing on our desire for shower scenes.
Right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We
to
now
see your star of the shower.
We are now taught to fear what we desire.
I know, right?
And that is a nasty, nasty trick that Hitchcock plays on us. You know, look, just the images of the house up on the hill are scary. Taxidermy is scary.
I know.
And yes, showering without a good lock on the door will always be scary. We will all of us who've ever seen that film, think about it whenever we're in a strange place showering without a lock on the door.
I think of something else. You know, I watched that again recently when I was going through some sort of Hitchcocky slight marathon, and there was because he used the television film crew from his series in order to meet the budget demands, it also feels more intimate than a lot of the other movies like The Birds and stuff, where he had a film crew and they were shooting more in the 1950s Technicolor wider panorama stuff. And because this is like a TV crew, a lot of the shots and stuff are tighter and more intimate. And that also gives it much more dread than, say, The Birds, which is another Hitchcock classic, but to me, not...
Well,
that's weird.
Interesting. So you're right, and I think that's one of the reasons I was kind of struck by the fact that, look, this did not get great reviews when it came out. It was mixed to panned by critics, and yet it got 4 Academy Award nominations for Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, Janet Leigh, Best Black and White Cinematography, and Art Direction. And to me, you're absolutely right. The reason that it could get these, despite the bad reviews, was because of the intimacy that this film created that really stood out. And that's what the Academy sought to reward. The nightmare side of every boy's love affair with his mother, right, makes this kind of what was called the first psychoanalytical thriller. And,
right.
And again, operating on this premise of where there's fear, there's desire, right? His fear of his mother masks his desire for his mother. So it is really rich, and yet it has a great sense of humor about itself. And like you said, the intimacy is kind of what stays with you and keeps you. If you just turn this film on and there's Marion Crane in a hotel room with Norman Bates, you're watching it. You're sitting down and watching it because the scenes are delicious.
It's so good. So good.
So what's your number one?
Well, I got to think it's our same number one because nobody's mentioned it up till now. One of my favorite Stanley Kubrick films with Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, it's The Shining.
I might say that it's my favorite Kubrick film to have Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall in it. Of all of his, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you know what? What's crazy is it's not even one of my, I mean, look, he only made 11 films, but it's not my favorite Kubrick. It's not Clockwork Orange. It's not 2001. It's not Dr. Strangelove, but it is the one of his films that I want to watch every single month. And it's the one where the more I learn about Stanley Kubrick's making of it, the scarier the movie itself actually becomes.
Oh, Really?
I mean, like the moment you notice, you know, because you'll notice stuff. There's no end to the things that you can pay attention to and notice in this film. But how about when Danny's playing on the carpet outside room 237 and the ball rolls out to him, and you notice that from the wide shot to the close-up on him, the patterning on the carpet has changed. So it's this huge continuity error. But of course, what it meant was Kubrick stopped and had the crew come in, pull up the entire floor, and relay it with different carpeting just to shoot the close-up. So it's intentional, and that sort of shit makes it really unsettling. You realize that nothing is as you thought it was, no matter how many times you've seen the film. When Jack Nicholson's Jack Torrance is going in to meet with Barry Nelson's character, right, to take the caretaker job, and there's that third guy in the room, and in every shot, his clothes are changing.
Yeah, I know, right? So it's completely, and as you say, you know, each one of these films has, it resonates in terms of feminism or things going on culturally. This one resonates on so many levels, perhaps because it's so unsettling and so weird. Like there's,
because we don't understand what the point of view is that we are supposed to, quote unquote, hold, right?
Right.
Roger Ebert wrote these questions. Who is the reliable observer? Whose idea of events can we trust? It is this elusive open-mindedness that makes Kubrick's film so strangely disturbing. And I would add it's that openness that makes it continuously and ever-deepeningly disturbing.
Right. Yeah, because as time goes on, it resonates more and more with like you could watch it today and think it's about today's issues of terrorism, of political upheaval. All of that stuff still can be found elements throughout this movie.
It like so many of these others, mixed reviews when it first opened. It was the first of his films to open wide less than a month after its two-city Memorial Day limited run. For people who don't know, in the film, Jack Torrance, a writer and recovering alcoholic, takes a job as an off-season caretaker at the isolated Overlook Hotel. His young son possesses psychic abilities and is able to see things from the past and the future, such as the ghosts who haunt the hotel. Sometime after settling in, the family is trapped in the hotel by a snowstorm, and Jack gradually becomes influenced, we believe, by a ghostly presence and descends into madness and ultimately violence. There's been much made about reading it as a treatise on the genocide against Native Americans, as a treatise on the Holocaust. And
they made a documentary about that.
And the truth is there is much to support these readings, as well as countless others. And they almost always come back, though, to the nature of evil and the duality of man. And those are topics that you can continue to delve into round and round, viewing after viewing, much like little Danny wheeling around the long haunting corridors or Jack descending further into impotent, rage-filled powerlessness. There's always going to be more to see, to hear, to realize, to learn, and with each new viewing, this film becomes more terrifying.
Well, and that's what a great work of art's supposed to be, right? Something that you can look on again and again and still have it have power and more power with each interpretation.
And more power to us, because although we're over time by a handful of minutes already, not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. I'm so glad we did this. This was even more fun than I anticipated.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
I've got to see the Ringu.
Ringu, yeah. Go see the original Ringu. I'll see Tales from the Gimli Hospital. And we'll be in person on next week's show.
Yay!
Face-to-face here in Los Angeles, a big city with a Spanish name. until then, I'm Phil Lernes.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Belated spoiler alert.